we kind of believe that there's this irony in the fact that VCs spend all this time thinking about and investing in the future, and yet, you know, our industry has been kind of culturally stuck in the past. Not surprising to me, but like, you know, the alpha around consumer is just, the potential is so much more significant, right? And I just think, I love enterprise, I love B2B, but like, if you're not actively sort of putting consumer into your portfolio, you're leaving a lot of opportunity on the table.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to FinTech Leaders, coming to you from New York City. I'm your host, Miguel Armaza. And I'm a co-founder of Gilgamesh Ventures, a venture capital fund that backs early stage fintech entrepreneurs in the US, Canada, and Latin America. Now, if you enjoyed this conversation, I invite you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever you get your show so more people can learn about FinTech Leaders. My guest today is Lauren Kolodny, co-founder and managing partner at Acrew Capital, a multi-stage venture capital fund with over $1 billion in assets under management. Some of their fintech investments include Chime, Gusto, Coinbase, Built, Vanta, and Klar. We discuss lessons from over a decade of investing in technology and fintech, a bullish case for consumer fintech, Lauren's philosophy on developing talent from within, how Acrew covers multiple industries and keeps their ear to the ground, and a lot more. So let's go back even before the founding of Acrew. Let's go back to learn a little bit about you, right? Where are you from within the US, and then what led you down the path of first tech? I know you spent some time at Google, but then for most of the last decade, venture capital investing.
Yes. So maybe I'll start from the beginning, because I think it gives a little insight into why I'm at where I'm at now. So I grew up in Solana Beach, which is a little town in North County, San Diego. Sort of at that time, it was sort of part hippie surfer town, part sort of vibrant Mexican immigrant community. And it's changed a lot since then. In fact, now I think it's known among our circles as sort of as the namesake for Solana. So it gives you a sense for how much it's changed.
So there is a relationship between the two.
Yes. And I think the Solana founders, apparently, when they were working at Qualcomm, would go surfing at Pillbox Beach in Solana Beach. And that's how they named the protocol, which is where I used to go to the beach as a kid. So it's funny thinking back on that. But anyway, you know, growing up there, I think, especially with its proximity to the border, I was always really struck by the disparity between, you know, kind of my world and this, you know, place that was in such close geographic proximity. And so I think that's sort of where I got passionate about economic development. And at the same time, I was really interested in technology. And so when I went to Brown as an undergrad, I, you know, and Brown being a place that really allows you to sort of construct your own education, I sort of put the two things together. So I ended up studying technology as a driver for economic development. And so I took, you know, my first job was actually with the Clinton Foundation. So very different life than what I do now, but I was based in India, in Delhi. And I had originally gone there, you know, to work on clean tech partnerships. This was, you know, shortly after an Inconvenient Truth. So there was a lot of momentum around clean tech. But then 2008 hit and the recession came into full swing and the mandate just kind of dried up. And so what happened was I ended up spending a bunch of time with entrepreneurs who are working on early iterations of mobile money. And, you know, this was pre sort of M-Pesa being a big thing. PayPal was still relatively early in the States. And it sort of was this like aha moment for me of this thing called financial technology, obviously not really called fintech back then, has this potential to drive financial inclusion around the world. And I got really excited about it. So I ended up coming back to the States and I got a job at Google in product marketing, kind of somehow finagled my way into a role in product marketing on what was then their, what was called Google Apps, now Google Workspace. So sort of the early days of consumerization of enterprise, pulling together a lot of the consumer productivity apps, you know, for business. I led the Google Drive launch and a bunch of others. And so, you know, was spending more time in the Valley. And meanwhile, I'd been asked to join the board of trustees at Brown as a young alum. And it was on the board that I got to know Teresa Gao, who's now my partner, co-managing partner and co-founder here at ACRO. We were on the board together and worked on a bunch of projects for the university together. And, you know, between being at Google and spending time with Teresa, I sort of got this foray into the world of venture capital. And then I went to Stanford Business School. And as I was gearing up to graduate, Teresa let me know she was thinking about leaving Excel to start her own firm. So the stars kind of aligned, and I joined her as the first person hired on the team as a partner there and built out our fintech investing practice.
So there's a lot to talk about. Let's start with the story of ACRO, right? Because I know it's not your usual VC story, not is, but let's hear it from your point of view.
Yeah. So my co-founders and I worked together at our predecessor firm, which was Aspect, as I mentioned. And we invested there out of two funds. And, you know, as we were gearing up for fund three, I think we all kind of recognized that there were some philosophical differences in terms of how the collective group wanted to build the firm. And we felt we were too early in our life cycle for that. So the five of us decided that we would spin out and found ACRO. And one of the things that I think, you know, looking back, was really special about that was like, here are five people who had experience working together in venture, like knew that we were very aligned in terms of what we wanted to build and made the choice to work together again. So, you know, I think that really set us up for success in interesting ways. And while I sort of wouldn't wish having that kind of transition on anyone, I think it created an opportunity for us to sort of restart and be really reflective about what we wanted to build. So, you know, just to give you an example, like we worked with a coach when we started the firm. We did a lot of interpersonal coaching and really, you know, thought about who we wanted to be in this new iteration. And there are a couple sort of key things that came out of it. One was that we wanted to be very values driven. So I think we kind of believe that there's this irony in the fact that VCs spend all this time thinking about and investing in the future. And yet, you know, our industry has been kind of culturally stuck in the past. And for better or worse, venture has this kind of outsized cultural impact, right? And, you know, just as you know, Miguel, it's like, you know, we sit on boards that impact founders, that impact, you know, huge teams. And so one person and the way that they sort of approach that kind of partnership can have ripple effects. And so we really wanted to do the values thing and the way that we show up culturally differently. So, you know, our name is ACRO because we really orient around the crew and operating as a team and being collaborative. We've made a big commitment, you know, to being the most trusted partners to each other and to the teams that we serve. We also invest in our own ongoing development. That's a really core part of sort of our belief system. And we really believe that diversity drives the best outcomes. And so that shows up in a lot of the things that we do. The other big part of it, and this was true to a certain extent Aspect as well, is that we wanted to be really thesis driven. You know, we spent a lot of time thinking about organizational design. And, you know, the way that we're structured is that we have three thesis areas: fintech, data and security, and consumer networks. And each one is a dedicated team, right? There's at least one senior partner leading the team lead and a dedicated, you know, team of investors around it. And what that means is like we really develop a lot of depth of expertise, depth of networks. And so we think, you know, that we're as deep as a lot of our counterparts that have entire, you know, dedicated specialist firms. And that's what we aim to achieve. At the same time, we get the benefit of some interdisciplinary collaboration. So each person spends 20% of their time in another area. And that means that, you know, we can think more holistically. And some of our best investments have actually spanned multiple of the thesis areas. And so it's sort of playing out. So that's a little bit about the backstory and the ethos.
So diversity is a topic that obviously very people talk about, less so these days than they did in 2021, if I'm honest. But there is the diversity around, you know, a founding team that you can pay attention to. But once you've made the investment, are you kind of putting certain goals for companies, or are you tracking, like, how are you measuring the diversity of the companies you back?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I think we've kind of taken a different approach to it, which was, So if you rewind all the way back to Aspect, I think I remember, you know, in the early days, we had, you know, reporters and co-investors and people that would want to put us in this bucket as being like the woman-led firm. And in some ways, I think we tried to distance ourselves from that a little bit because we wanted to be, and we felt we had earned the right to be known for a lot more. I think what happened, though, and what was interesting is, you know, in those couple funds and then in founding Acre, we recognized that founders were really coming to us wanting our help to think about the diversity of their teams, of their boards. You know, of course, they wanted our expertise first and foremost, but that was something that just sort of was a repeated, some of the, and in particular from non-diverse teams, you know, that we were working with or that we're thinking about working with, that would ask us for recommendations for people because they were getting the same sort of names over and over from, you know, executive search firms, and they had perceived, I think rightfully so, that we had some differentiated networks. So in 2021, we launched our Diversified Capital Fund, which is a growth fund, but where we were really mindful of who was investing that fund. So we have several hundred executives that are a truly diverse and representative group, like in the truest sense of the word. You know, and that sort of formed the basis for this executive network that we have now that we sort of bring to bear for our companies. And they end up being talent, you know, independent board member candidates, advisors, they open up their networks. And so one of the things that we've done is less about, you know, we don't have a specific mandate around investing in diversity, but what we care about is helping our teams when they want this from us to make sure that they have diverse perspectives around the table. And so that's kind of how we approach it.
Lauren, there's a reason private markets are called private, right? There isn't a lot of information out there, but information is crucial, is key for when we are trying to make an investment. Tell us about ACRU's approach to keeping your ear to the ground. You know, as a team, what have you found? What are your best techniques to cover as much ground and then gather as much information as possible for you to make a good investment decision?
So I think in terms of covering ground, just to make sure we're talking about the right people in the first place, I think that I would say it sort of boils down to two things. One is that, you know, I mentioned we're really thesis driven, but that actually means something for us in terms of every 3 to 6 months, each of our teamlets, our thematic areas, are doing proactive work, you know, to really establish what are the opportunities that are most exciting to us right now. And it's, you know, it's often driven by what's happening, you know, macroeconomically, what are the technology trends, you know, any number of factors, socioeconomic, societal trends. I mean, all of these things kind of play into the thinking. And we kind of go through this pretty rigorous, both tops down and bottoms up process to establish what those are. I think when you're doing that, you come in much more informed about a space. And so it's easier to have the conviction because you're being methodical about, you know, talking to as many people in a particular area as you can. And it means that a lot of the investments we make are proactive, like they're proactively sourced by us. And so that's one part of it. I think the other part, again, to sort of making sure we are always kind of talking to the right people and, you know, covering what is, I mean, fintech in and of itself, obviously, as you know, Miguel, is a huge area. I mean, you could argue whether it really is one area, but I think that this applies across the board. Like, I find it's really simple, but like, you know, I'm fortunate to have a lot of really impressive friends and contacts in the industry. And I think one of the things that some of us forget to do, and I try to remind myself, is every time I talk to somebody, I ask them who's the most interesting person you know that's building something right now, right? Like, I mean, it's simple, but you'd be surprised by how often that won't come up if you don't ask the question. And when you do, like the caliber of responses you get can be really off the charts. And so like, those are the two, like, of course, there are many other strategies. I have a lot of great co-investor friends like yourself. And, you know, they are great sources too. But I think like that kind of really is the crux of it, is those two things.
Yeah, it's the saying, out of sight, out of mind, is very real. Sometimes you talk to someone, they might like you, but it hasn't crossed their mind to introduce you to that other person that might be building something. Let's zoom in on fintech, right? It's certainly what I spend 99% of my time doing. I know you spend a lot of time in fintech as well. What's your outlook? You've been investing in fintech pre-hype and now, let's call it post-hype. Where do you think it's going?
I mean, look, it's been a rough few years. No one would debate that. I know both of us have been through a lot trying to helping our companies to navigate this time. But I would say with a longer term view, I'm continue to be extremely optimistic about fintech. I mean, I think that we're only scratching the surface on efficiency gains in this industry. You know, our mutual friends at Clock Tower presented some interesting data around, you know, if you look at the GDP per employee in the industry or in financial services as a measure of kind of efficiency gains and from technology in financial services relative to so many other industries, financial services is, you know, only barely scratching the surface compared to retail and healthcare and all these other spaces. And so, you know, I think, you know, that coupled with the fact that when you look at the market cap of fintechs relative to legacy financial institutions, I mean, it's a tiny fraction. Like, and there's still 1.5 billion adults globally that are unbanked and like 3 billion that are underbanked. I mean, there is so much go forward opportunity here. I also think that like in a time of macroeconomic volatility is when consumers and businesses become more open to making changes in their financial stacks. And so I actually think right now is the best time to be building. And look, and there's still, you know, yes, like the markets have come back some on the public side. But if you look at like the fintech EV multiples today versus kind of the median in 2018, 2019 before the hype, we're still, you know, over like we're 36%, I think, I mean, down from that, you know, so there's still a lot of room, you know, for things to come back from a market perspective. And I just think the opportunity is vast.
Yeah, absolutely. And how about like new companies that you're backing? I know if I look at your portfolio, there's a good mix of B2B, B2B2C, and also B2C, which is, you know, direct to consumer fintechs. I mean, one of those, correct me if I'm wrong, but is Chime, and, you know, arguably the most successful neobank in the US. You have publicly spoken in favor of continuing to back early stage consumer founders. That is not a popular opinion amongst VCs today. Why are you bullish on consumer?
It actually kind of comes back to Chime in a way. So if you think about, let's go back in time a little bit. If you think about the early 2010s, right, when I think most of the more interesting B2C companies of that kind of cohort were founded, like Chime, like Nubank, like Coinbase, and, you know, Robinhood to a certain extent. And then also like the B2B to C companies like Stripe and Block. You know, I think a few things were really true at that point in time that enabled that first, what I would consider to be the first major wave of sort of generationally transformative fintech, you know, consumer and B2B2C fintech companies. And the way that I think about it was there was the macro environment. So, you know, this was in the wake of 2008. There had been all this banking industry failures and, you know, there was this massive loss in confidence in the traditional financial system. There was a big demographic shift happening with millennials coming of age and entering the workforce and sort of being the first quasi-digitally native generation and sort of more open to digital-first solutions. And then there was a technological disruption in mobile with, you know, the iOS App Store kind of really being launched in 2008 and sort of gaining momentum in those early 2010s. And so that was the background context for all of these companies, right? And it was part of the thesis work that I did at the time that got me conviction to invest in Chime, which, by the way, was not a popular choice at that time. I mean, Chris Britt will talk about, you know, that he pitched hundreds of investors, and I was the only one, you know, crazy enough to say yes. But, you know, it's funny now, but like the idea of a neobank was just kind of dismissed by most other investors. And it was doing that thesis work that got me the conviction. And that Chime, I thought, was really doing an interesting thing to take advantage of those trends. And also that, you know, they were really serving a part of the population that was just so underserved by traditional financial services, the 70% of Americans living paycheck to paycheck. And so, you know, and then of course, Chris and Ryan are just phenomenal entrepreneurs. So that's, you know, how I got the conviction to do it then. I think what's, you know, funny to me now is that there is a real parallel in terms of what's going on. kind of on a macro level, right? The economy has been through a bunch of volatility, right? There's, you know, there are different pains, but consumers and businesses are feeling real pain as a result of inflation and interest rates, high interest rates and banking failures. And then there's a demographic shift with Gen Z sort of really coming of age and starting to put together their financial lives and, you know, being the first real true digital native generation, having a lot of unique characteristics to millennials. And then the last thing is, as we all know, we're going through a massive technological disruption with AI. So when you put those things together, again, it's like the same ingredients are in the water. And to me, in spite of the fact that, sure, everyone, you know, there's been a ton of activity over the last 5 years in consumer fintech, and I think people feel that it's saturated and fatigued. But the reality is these shifts create space for new opportunities. And so that's why I think it's like the time to be building. I guess the last thing I would say, I don't know, Miguel, if you saw, like, Forerunner, who's actually one of my co-investors in Chime, put out a thing a couple weeks ago about, you know, showcasing sort of data for consumer companies. And, you know, not surprising to me, but, like, you know, the alpha around consumers, is just the potential is so much more significant, right? And I just think I love enterprise, I love B2B, but, like, if you're not actively sort of putting consumer into your portfolio, you're leaving a lot of opportunity on the table. And so that's more of a general comment, but that's why I'm convicted about right now for consumer fintech.
Yeah, I guess what a lot of investors say is they can at least feel like they have more confidence investing in enterprise because they understand better the needs of the enterprises, knowing what's going to hit with consumers. I think Matt Harris from Bain Capital told me it's like predicting fashion, right? And I guess that's part of the hesitation of a lot of people. What do you think about that?
I mean, Matt and I have debated this before. Look, I think there's a distinction between consumer fintech and consumer internet more broadly, right? I don't consider myself someone that is going to have the, you know, the pulse on what is going to be the next consumer of social app. That's, you know, but I think that fintech, it's, like I said, it's so intertwined with these things that you can study and that are known, right? Like these macroeconomic shifts, demographic shifts, other societal shifts. I mean, and so I think that, and the pains are well understood, right? I think part of the challenge, like a lot of consumer internet businesses build for like this consumer aspiration. Like I think the best consumer fintech businesses build for real pain, and pains are relatively knowable. So I guess I think, yes, I mean, doesn't mean it's easy to predict, but to me, there is more of a methodology around determining where the opportunity exists than I think Matt might believe.
Laura, let's talk a bit about the business of venture capital. You know, I think it's not a secret that it's far more painful to say no, to avoid investing in a company that ends up doing amazingly well, than to invest in a company that unfortunately does not do well and shuts down their doors. Every investor you talk to has had some painful passes. Do you think about those a lot? How do you approach, you know, your anti-portfolio, I guess?
I think I thought about them a lot more earlier in my career. And what's interesting is that, you know, a lot of time the heartburn was around companies that I perceived to be doing really well and then, you know, maybe went a different direction. But there are plenty that, you know, of course, if I could go back in time and make a different decision, I would. But I think the thesis orientation helps because there's kind of a process and a method around like what I'm saying yes to versus what I'm not. And I don't always pick the right company, right? But like, I think that, you know, if I feel like I picked the right space, like that helps. I think that the other thing that I've done to sort of, or that we've done, which also helps is that, you know, we launched a growth fund, as I mentioned, a couple years back, and it enables us to go back to the companies where maybe we should have said yes and invest. So, you know, as an example, I mean, one that sticks out to me, and it wasn't exactly a pass, but I didn't get there quickly enough as I should have, was Plaid. Like I was meeting them just as they got their term sheet for the A. And so, you know, what was nice though is obviously I'm very interconnected as a result of all of my companies, you know, for a very long time, being Plaid customers and ended up in one of their later stage rounds investing. So, you know, there are ways to kind of account for that, I guess. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, it's a portfolio game. And as long as you invest in a couple of them that really, you know, have the outsized performance, like, I think it doesn't matter who you are. Like, the best investors, all of us have significant anti-portfolios, right? I mean, a lot of people made comments to me around Chime about regret on that one, you know, again, because it was like so widely seen. And you know, but at the end of the day, you just have to kind of have a balanced perspective on what's there and what's not there and be grateful for the right decisions that you made and take the learnings from the wrong ones.
What I'm hearing partially is what a mentor will tell a young up-and-coming investor, right? And that's also partially what you do at Acru. You start as a team of five, but you've grown. And one of the hardest things in our business is training talent that, you know, down the line is going to be carrying the torch, you know, and, you know, many years in the future. Tell us about your approach to hiring and nurturing people within the firm.
So this is really important to us. And I think, like, Miguel, there's almost like an assumption behind the question, which I want to call out, which is like, I think the first thing is there's some decisions that you have to make when you're starting a firm, right? And you have to decide, like, is your intention to really develop talent, right? And I think if you say clearly that the answer is no, that's a perfectly acceptable answer, right? If you say it's yes, then that means you have to have a real strategy around doing so. I think the challenge is when you don't make an explicit decision, right? And it extends not just to the development, but, like, presumably if you're going to really develop, you're also interested in, you know, allowing people to grow within the firm. You're interested in generational transition, you know, making sure that the firm lives on and that there's, you know, the potential for generational transition. That all of these things have to be, in my opinion, sort of thought through and conceptualized really early on to make sure the structure and the firm and its incentives are such that, like, those things are possible. So we made a really deliberate decision that we wanted to invest in the development of our team, that we wanted to have people have the opportunity to make it all the way. And so there are a lot of things we did to set that up structurally. And like I mentioned, one of our values is actually, you know, this strong belief in the ongoing development of ourselves and the people that we serve. So a couple of the more tactical things that we do, you know, I think the organizational design, as I mentioned, has been one big piece of this, because I think that having earlier career people staffed on a well-scoped area allows them to see trends quicker, to develop some expertise, to start having more conviction faster. It's not the only way to do it, but I think, to me, I've seen the ability for investors to ramp their careers and get stronger judgment faster with that focus is, like, it's pronounced. So that's part of it. And, you know, at the same time, if all they're seeing is one thing, they kind of lose the ability to see patterns across industries. And so that's why, again, that 20% is really time is really for that, for them to kind of get exposure in other places and see the parallel. And then, you know, we really believe in coaching, both in terms of the way that we work with our team. So each person has a kind of day-to-day manager and a coach, and they serve different purposes. Like, the day-to-day manager is what you would imagine, but the coach is really kind of to help. They're not necessarily in that person's thematic area. It's really to talk about long-term goals, to, you know, get feedback on, you know, whatever might be top of mind. That is really valuable. And then the other thing that we've done, and particularly for kind of mid-career people that are starting to develop their own portfolio and take board seats and that kind of thing, is actually invest in you know, outside coaching or facilitated groups for our team, because we really believe that interpersonal development is such a huge and important part of this job. So those are a few things.
Yeah, that's interesting. And then kind of from the point of view of the people rising within the firm over the last few years, you know, what has stood up to you as traits that these people have to become great investors? You mentioned interpersonal skills. Completely agree. That's super important. But what else would you like to highlight?
You know, I think it's the people that seem to accelerate quickly, have a great deal of self-awareness And so they lean in on their strengths and really see that, like, perhaps that's actually more important than trying to address areas of weakness. I mean, depending on what it is, but because, like, to win in this game, like, you have to be the best at something, right? And so I think that that's part of it. And then but the self-awareness helps in that, you know, those that can see, like, hey, I might have a blind spot around this, or this is not the thing that is, you know, I don't trust my own instincts or capabilities here. They then kind of go to the other team members who have those strengths and sort of lean on them. And that's part of, like, this really, like, the one crew, the really collaborative environment, multiple people on each deal team. We're not really, you know, overly fixated on attribution and that kind of thing. And I think what it does is people are not sharp elbows. We like to say that we're competitive with ourselves, but not with each other. And so, you know, I think that when I see people rising through the organization, identifying the areas where they should be leaning on others, you know, to help fill in their blind spots or to help create guardrails for them, like, that's a really good sign. So those are some of the things that I think matter the most, in addition to, you know, just like a belief in interpersonal development, right? Because at the end of the day, like, you know, so much of this job is influencing people. And if you don't have a true investment in, you know, enhancing your emotional intelligence, in improving the way you show up for people, then, you know, I just think in this area of venture capital, like, you're not going to win.
Yeah, I love that. Doubling down on your strengths is certainly something I live by. If you were to launch a crew today all over again, what would you do differently?
It's a good question. You know, the first thing that comes to mind, maybe the answer that I should give is that I would build with more tech and AI. And I guess the actual answer is a version of that. But it's really just that, I think, coming back to the last conversation, I myself, as a founder, need to lean in on my strengths. And that means, I think what I probably would do is sooner, you know, earlier on, figure out how to take everything else off of my plate as much as possible, right? And that might be building, you know, some automation and, you know, taking some of the process work out. That might be hiring great operational team members earlier to kind of, you know, to enable me to focus on what I think is my most important job, which is making great investments and developing our investment team. And so I think, honestly, that's the biggest thing. It would have just been taking out a lot of the noise. You know, I think I was having fun building, and it's like, this has been my kind of founder moment, as you know, Miguel. And, like, you know, it's like the same advice I give my founders, which is, like, you really got to figure out what needs to be you, and, like, everything else needs to go somewhere else. And that I think I would have structured better from the outset. If that seems like kind of a lame answer, I think, you know, maybe there should be something more foundational. I mean, the truth of the matter is, like, there's not a lot I would change. I feel really lucky for, you know, my team and, you know, our ethos. And I, like I said, I think a lot of that comes from the fact that, like, we didn't get it right the first time and we were forced to do it again. And in doing so, we could just be so much more reflective. So I got that second chance start, which, you know, most people don't. And it's been a real advantage in a lot of ways.
Lauren, before we run out of time, I've noticed that a lot of investors are also voracious readers. I'm not sure how much you read, but I'd love to hear if there's a book or two that you tend to recommend often.
One of the books that I recommend most often, I think about most often, which maybe isn't that surprising when you hear what the topic is, but it's a little bit of a throwback. It's an early 2010s book called Moonwalking with Einstein. So, and it's probably not surprising that I think about it a lot, because the topic is about, you know, people that train their memories, basically like athletes train their bodies. And I love that book for a couple reasons. One, I have pretty bad ADHD. And so remembering things like names and data, it doesn't come super easily for me. As you know, Miguel, in venture, like, that's a pretty table stakes skill. And so, you know, but, like, I liked, so one of the things that I learned from it, I kind of like to give as an example, is, like, you know, to create these really crazy visual associations in your mind to help remember things. So, like, You know, let's say you're meeting a founder whose name is Christina and runs like a French payments company. So then I would think, okay, well, what is my closest association? Who is my closest association with Christina, that name? And the answer would be Christina Paxson, the president of Brown. So then I would think, okay, visualize Christina Paxson on Brown's main green with the Eiffel Tower in the center, you know, standing next to Christina, the founder, and they're both holding cash in their hands. And all of a sudden, like, I have this ability to sort of to retain. And so that's one of the reasons that I think it's great for others that have that challenge. The other thing is, it's like this really inspiring story of what's possible when someone, you know, in this case, the author, but who perceives themselves as being kind of average at something, and even something that I think a lot of us perceive as being as innate as memory, you know, dedicates a bunch of time to learning the strategies, you know, to compete with the people that are best at this in the world. And it's like this quite literal mind expansion. And I think about that a lot in the context of my own development and, you know, in the founders that I back, because I think, you know, the ability to do that, to efficiently and effectively learn something new, is like, it's such an important part of being a founder. So anyway, that's why that book is top of mind.
Love it. Love it. I think I just read about that book because it's referenced in another book that's related. It's called Peak. And it's the guy who did a lot of the experiments for number memorization, Anders Ericsson. So he writes about it. And I think the first 100 pages are mostly about a lot of the characters in moonwalking with Einstein.
Funny.
Well, Lauren, thanks for educating all of us. Thanks for taking the time out of your very, very busy schedule amongst running a firm, investing, and being in multiple boards. So I appreciate it. And, you know, let's keep co-investing.
Would love it, Miguel. Thank you for having me. It's great chatting today and excited for more of your great podcasts.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this great episode with Lauren from Acrew Capital. If you want more interviews, make sure to subscribe, follow, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. It helps and truly, truly means a lot. If you have any suggestions or thoughts about the show, just drop me a line on Twitter or LinkedIn. Signing off till next week, I'm your host, Miguel Armaza.